Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What responsibility do humans have for the wild creatures affected by our industry and development? Different species of pelican can be found on every continent except Antarctica. They are smart, social, and beautiful to watch in flight. But they've been adversely affected by habitat destruction, climate change, oil spills, commercial fishing, and ocean pollution. And although brown pelicans were removed from the U.S. Endangered Species List in 2009, they are still a subject of great concern for those who wish to see them survive and thrive. Filmmaker Judy Irving directed the new documentary Pelican Dreams. It opens Friday at the Angelica Film Center in Dallas. Judy, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
The film begins with a pelican blocking traffic in, of all places, the Golden Gate Bridge. Can you talk about what it was about that incident that caught your attention?
A friend of mine was in that traffic jam, and she sent me an email and said, "You'll never guess why I was held up in traffic on the bridge today. A pelican blocked the roadway. Police cars came and arrested the bird, put the bird into the car, drove it off the bridge, and I felt like I had the beginning of a movie. It was just a good dramatic narrative arc start, and it was at an iconic location, the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco.
So you followed up and found out where this pelican was taken.
Yeah, I followed the bird. We found a YouTube video of this event very soon after it happened, and I was able to call the bridge patrol folks and find out where they had taken the bird. So I followed the bird into captivity and named her Gigi for Golden Gate. And just she became one of the two avian stars of Pelican Dreams as I hung out with her in this aviary and as she recuperated.
When you see, you know, a flock of pelicans in flight, it's a little hard to tell one from another. But the film, it really showed me that when you sort of pay attention to them on an individual basis, they have individual personalities.
They definitely do. One of the first things that I had to learn was literally how to tell a young bird from an adult, for instance, by the plumage. And then beyond that, following two avian ambassadors from the pelican world, I realized how different their personalities are. I think that, you know, if you really focus closely enough on any species, you'll see that. It's not a surprise.
Your early sense of pelicans was that they reminded you of flying dinosaurs, graceful in the air and clumsy on the ground. And then, as you got to know these animals better, that perception started to change for you.
Right. You know, when I started the film and when I started basically thinking about pelicans years ago, they just have that ancient look about them. They do look like they're from the age of dinosaurs. And in fact, birds are dinosaurs, we're told now by scientists. And I had the usual cliches going in my mind. Yes, elegant while soaring, awkward on the ground, et cetera, et cetera. But then as I got into the movie and started learning about what it's like to be a pelican on this planet in the 21st century, I just found out an awful lot more about them. I found out how they grow up, how they learn to fly, what they're up against once they do fly. And I just got a tremendous amount of increased respect for them as I learned more about them. And you'll see that in the movie. You'll see all those chapters in a pelican's life.
One thing that surprised me is that as beautiful as they are in flight, they're so big with that 7-foot wingspan, they don't weigh very much. I mean, are they actually pretty delicate in when you get close up to them?
Yeah, basically they're very big, tall birds, and they do have a 6 or 7 foot wingspan, the brown pelicans anyway. Some of the white ones are even bigger than that with 11 foot wingspans. And some of the white pelicans can weigh up to 30 pounds, but the birds that I was concentrating on in Pelican Dreams are the ones who fly along the coasts, the Atlantic coast, the Gulf coast, and the Pacific coast, and those are brown pelicans. And they only weigh 8 to 10 pounds. So even though they're huge, they are birds, and they have very light bones, and they're basically bones and feathers, you know, light bones and feathers, and not much else.
What they eat, I guess, do they have an all-fish diet? Is that what they would eat in the wild?
I'm sure that they would prefer fish. The brown pelicans in the along the Pacific coast like anchovies and sardines and smelt and so forth. I'm not sure what the ones in the Gulf eat. But sometimes they'll eat crustaceans. And when they're really, really hungry, you saw in the film, there was a sort of an unprecedented situation a couple of years ago when some young, hungry brown pelicans landed in a common murre colony, which is another seabird, and started shaking the chicks to try to get the fish that the murre parents had fed the chicks. And then sometimes they even ate the chicks. So it's what they eat runs the gamut. They also will go after food scraps that fishermen throw to them. And sometimes that ends up to be a fatal error because maybe they'll get a fish head stuck in their neck or fish bones, a skeleton, you know, after somebody has filleted a fish, they just throw it back into the water. That's really, really dangerous for pelicans.
Because pelicans have evolved to eat these small fish that they catch themselves rather than big chunks that someone has tossed into the water.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They swallow them whole. They dive. The brown pelicans dive from up to 50 or 60 feet up, down, and catch them in their pouches, which they use as fish nets. And they, you know, they sort of clamp down the beak closed on the fish, and then they drain the water out, and then they throw their head back and swallow the fish whole. So that doesn't work too well if you've got a huge tuna head in your mouth and you try to swallow that. It's quite a common problem, and it ends up often killing the bird because they can't get the fish waste out of their neck or pouch, and then they can't fish themselves and they starve.
There are a number of scenes in the film where we see pelicans sort of in distress and someone comes along to help them, a person comes along, and the bird struck me as remarkably calm and gentle when, you know, someone's trying to help them, but they couldn't possibly know that. They're not trying to sort of peck at people who approach them. They just seem very, very calm.
They do seem calm. They do seem calm. The wildlife rehabilitators who work with both seabirds and other birds like raptors, say hawks and falcons and so forth, see the difference and they note the difference. Pelicans seem to be calm and basically tolerant of human beings. And whether that's just part of their, you know, DNA, whether it's part of their personality from way back, or whether they've gotten used to hanging out with people at fish piers and in marinas and following fishing boats and so forth. I don't know where it comes from, but you see the calmness when they soar also. They just, I don't know, they kind of seem contented and they don't seem afraid. When they're in care, somebody's opening up their mouth and looking down their throat and they're taking blood and they're, you know, looking at the feathers to see if they're waterproof or not. And they kind of just take it. It's amazing. They're very good patients, according to wildlife rehabilitators who have dealt with them. They're good to work with and they also heal up really fast. So they're great.
Which I guess is a good thing because there is certainly there's not a lot of money in pelican rehabilitation. Can you talk about the kinds of people who choose to make this either their vocation or their avocation?
I didn't really know much about wildlife rehabilitation before I started this film, and I have really come to respect the folks who do it. There's probably a wildlife hospital in Dallas, I don't know, but the folks who work at these places normally are volunteers. There's a lot of unsung hero transport of animals. Like, say you see an animal in distress at the side of the road, and you call either a government agency, like in San Francisco, it's Animal Care and Control, or you call, say, the Humane Society, or you call your local wildlife hospital. Someone has to come out and get that animal and take it into care. Sometimes, in the case of a pelican, they have to stitch up a ripped pouch, or they have to set a broken bone, or if the bird is really hungry and emaciated, they have to feed them lots of fish, which is expensive. So it's just an amazing, it's like an underground railroad for wild animals. And these folks are making up for basically what we as human beings do to animals. Most of it's inadvertent, habitat loss, you know, sometimes pollution is inadvertent, oil spills and so forth. But the rehabilitators are basically trying to balance the scales a little bit. And for that reason, they want the animals to stay wild. They don't want them used to people. So they don't really treat them like pets or anything. They treat them like wild animals, and when they release them, they want them to be afraid of people because that makes them safer.
It was hard for you to fight the urge to treat Gigi like a pet, even though she wasn't staying with you. When you would see her, you felt connected to her.
Definitely. I was allowed to hang out in the Pelican Aviary at International Bird Rescue, which is about an hour northeast of San Francisco. And as long as I didn't hassle the birds, I could just sit in there for hours and film. And I tried to figure out what she was about, you know, what was her personality like compared to other pelicans in that aviary. And some of the things I saw were that at first she was very, very almost like shy and quiet, and she held back. She didn't play. And I think that must have been because she was emaciated and hungry and also dehydrated. And later I saw that she liked to hang out in a certain spot. If you're into feng shui, she liked to hang out in the back corner of the aviary pool so that she could look out at everybody and see everybody. But I didn't learn all that much about her because, you know, when you're rehabbing a wild animal, you're not supposed to hand feed them. You're not supposed to make eye contact. You're not even supposed to name them. And I kind of got away with staring at Gigi because I'm a filmmaker, I'm not a rehabber, and I also got away with naming her for the same reason. But I understand why rehabilitation folks do this. It's for the sake of the birds and the animals that they are turning loose again in the wild later.
We're speaking with filmmaker Judy Irving. Her documentary, Pelican Dreams, opens Friday at the Angelica Film Center in Dallas. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. With more than 100 courses and non-credit certificates for adults, from fine arts to history to financial planning, spring registration is now open. Registration and information at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Judy Irving. She's the filmmaker who directed Pelican Dreams, a documentary that opens Friday at the Angelica Film Center in Dallas. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think at kera.org. By the way, we will be bringing you the best of Think this holiday season, the weeks of Christmas and New Year's. We'd like to know your favorite interviews of the last year or so. You can email us your suggestions at think at kera.org, or you can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Judy, something that surprised me about pelicans, or something I didn't know before, is that they don't just find another pelican in the wild and sort of go to town. They have a breeding ground, and it's a pretty specific place on the Channel Islands in California, off the coast of California.
Right. Brown pelicans, California brown pelicans, nest in Baja and on the Channel Islands off California. And so I decided to go to the Channel Islands to see what Gigi's early life would have been like, what it was like for her parents to build a nest and what it was like for her to be a tiny gray chick and then growing up fighting like crazy in the nest with her siblings when she had fuzzy white feathers and then growing up and learning how to fly. I was particularly interested in how these birds who become gigantic very quickly on the nesting grounds, actually, how do they take that first flight? What does it feel like? And how scary is it? You know, you've spent your whole life on the ground, earthbound, and then you start to flap your wings and you realize, oh my God, my body was built for something else. I've got to try this, but I'm scared, you know. Anyway, it's a really fun sequence in the movie, the flying for the first time.
Oh, you have a really breathtaking scene where that's exactly what you capture. And I wonder, first of all, describe what happens in that scene and then talk about how long you had to wait to find a bird doing that.
Well, basically, I made 7 different trips to the Channel Islands to get on film all the different stages. You know, the parents gathering the sticks and building the nest and the little tiny gray chicks when they're real just hatched. And then the intermediate stage. And then the grown chicks who are actually bigger than their parents. They weigh more than their parents because the parents have been feeding them a lot. Starting to flap, flap, flap wings and hop around on the ground and kind of experiment with lift, you know. And I set up my camera at a certain place on the ridge where I could see both north and south along the ridge line that went down to the ocean. And so I had my eye on a couple of nests, and I knew that these birds had not flown yet. So I just spent hours waiting and watching, and I filmed a lot of several birds flapping like crazy, too. Like it's almost like they hang onto a branch or something and flap and flap and flap, and they get those muscles tuned up before they decide to take that final fateful leap into the air. I guess it's, you know, the equivalent for humans must be the first time you go hang gliding or something. Hmm. You know, what's it like to become airborne when you've never been airborne before? But I did manage to get 3 birds flying for the first time in slow motion. And I'm real happy about that.
What's remarkable is that once they figure it out, and then when they begin to just let themselves glide over the ocean, you have mm-hmm. this sense that, I mean, I this is anthropomorphizing, but like it must occur to them, oh, I know how to do this, and it is awesome.
Yes, right. When they first take off, you can see them just flapping hard, and their little legs are swaying back and forth under them, you know, and their big feet, webbed feet. They don't know what to do with their legs. And then after a few flaps, they put the legs back flat against their belly, you know, and then they realize, oh, I don't even have to flap. I can soar. And then they soar out over the ocean. And it just, yeah, it just gives you the chills. It's amazing. And if you've ever had flying dreams, you know what that feels like when you get airborne and you can soar. It's incredible. I always thought, you know, I had a fantasy that once they took off from the Channel Islands, in this case, Santa Barbara Island, that's where I was filming, that they would just head north, you know. They would immediately start the migration north along the Pacific coast because that's what they do eventually. But that's not what happens at all with these young birds. They soar out over the ocean, and then they realize, oops, I'm flying, but where am I going to go? Where am I going to land? You know, and I saw some funny crash landings back on the island, and I filmed some funny crash landings in the water, too, because they've been looking at this great expanse of blue all their young lives before they fly. But to land in it is something else again.
And, of course, they have to learn how to fish because their parents are not going to feed them forever.
Right. They have to learn how to fish. And this is a difficult thing for a young California brown pelican or the eastern brown pelicans that fly around the Gulf that Dallas folks would know about. Brown pelicans dive from a great height for their fish. Sometimes the dives are shorter if there's tons of fish and if they're easy to see. But sometimes they get way up there and they do this beautiful, acrobatic, Olympic, difficult dive where they hone in on a fish and they do this half twist up in the air and they come down and then they make their body into an arrow right at the end by pushing their wings flat against their body and going straight in with their beak straight in, and they get the fish with their net underneath, you know, with their pouch underneath the water. But that's a hard thing to learn, and it's something that young pelicans have to learn. Otherwise, they starve, you know, and that's why sometimes I think, you know, sometimes brown pelicans, young ones, start hanging out around fishing piers and marinas and boat docks and stuff because maybe they haven't perfected it because it's too tough. And maybe they're lazy and they want the handouts, you know. I don't know. But there is a lot of back and forth between humans and pelicans along the fishing grounds for sure.
So ideally, pelicans are, if they've been injured and someone takes them in, they're rehabbed until they can fly and go out and fish and survive on their own. What happens to the ones who are not in any pain or close to death or anything, but don't regain their ability to fly?
That is a good question, and that's something that I really didn't understand when I started this movie. I didn't understand that there's really no place for a pelican in this world if you can't see well and if you can't fly well. There are very few places for pelicans to go. Zoos don't necessarily want them. Zoos tend to have a hard time keeping pelicans alive. They're just not quite exotic enough, maybe. And there aren't that many other situations for pelicans. And so when Gigi was recuperating and had a setback because she got a parasite and she was losing weight again, I was asking Monty Merrick, the wildlife rehabilitator who is taking care of Gigi, well, what happens if, you know, you can't release a bird? Then what? And he said, euthanasia. And that was a huge shock to me. I was so naive. I didn't know that that's what happens with a lot of these wild animals that cannot be rehabilitated enough to go back and have a good life in the wild. So, you know, it all of a sudden became a lot more dramatic. Is Gigi going to get better from this parasite that she's got? Is she going to gain weight? Is she going to be able to fly again and be released? And another bird that I met along the way named Moro actually had a wing injury. It wasn't broken, but it was just a bad sprain sort of at the elbow. And the folks who were rehabilitating Moro did rehab on him for months, and it just never got better. He just couldn't fly, you know. And they kept thinking that maybe it would get better and that he could be released. But as you'll see in the movie, I got to know Moro pretty well because he was spending a lot of time in the backyard of these wildlife rehabilitators. And I got to know Moro the best of all the birds.
And you had the sense that even though he was well cared for and even loved by his human caretakers, that he was lonely. Moro was lonely.
Yeah, I mean, Moro, I just adore that bird as I've gotten to know him. He continues with his life. He's a wild pelican who, you know, for now can't fly. As you see in the movie, he gets curious about a duck in the yard who is also rehabilitating himself from a fish hook injury, Festus the duck. So they become friends and they waddle around the yard a little bit. And he takes baths and he has his places in the sun that he likes to sit in. He has a lot of freedom of choice in this wonderful yard at Danny and Bill Nicholson's house near Morro Bay. There are chickens there. There are geese. So he has other animal companionship. But he doesn't have a pelican friend. And pelicans are very social birds. They roost together at night. They often fish together. They just like to be together. So it's a bit of a sad life for Moro. And, of course, his caretakers have been looking for a friend for him. And that's part of the story. I don't want to give everything away.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Charles in Dallas. Hi, Charles.
Hi. I love the show here, and it's a great subject, but I wanted to bring up the fact that we get quite a few white pelicans, freshwater lake pelicans, that migrate here to White Rock Lake in Dallas. And they like to roost on the logs and tree limbs that are out in the lake. And sometimes they're roosting in Sunset Bay, and you can observe them quite easily. Sometimes they'll roost on the logs that are probably no more than 20 or 25 feet away from the shoreline. So there's a lot of people, a lot of photographers that come out there and can photograph them and post their pictures on the internet.
Well, thanks so much for that.
Yes, actually, white pelicans do have a cameo role in the movie. We filmed some white pelicans up at Pacheco Pond, which is north of San Francisco. You know how they do that wonderful, it's kind of like a ballet. When white pelicans feed, they don't dive, but they almost form like a semicircle, and they swim together. They herd the fish in front of them, and then they dip their heads in the water in a synchronized way. It's just a beautiful thing to see. So white pelicans definitely have a role in the movie, too, although they aren't the actual stars. And when you see the poster, the movie poster at the Angelica, it features a white pelican strolling along the path in St. James Park in London. There's white pelicans there, and it's just a fantastic photograph taken by a London photographer that kind of speaks to the relationships between pelicans and people and gets at a little bit of the humor that's in the film, too. So you should check that out.
I had no idea that pelicans, adult pelicans, don't vocalize, but they can communicate.
Exactly, yeah. When I started the film, I didn't know this either. I mean, when you think about a bird, you think that it has a call, it has a squawk, it has a cheep or a, you know, an alarm call or whatever. Well, young baby brown pelicans, chicks, make a begging sound that sounds almost like a sheep bleating, you know, feed me, feed me. And then as they get older, they completely lose their voice. So that adult pelicans only have this kind of breathing sound that they make. They sort of hunch their wings in a certain way, often on the nest, and sometimes in other situations too. And it forces air through their lungs, so you hear that sound. And you, in there's several scenes with Moro where you hear him making that noise. But they don't have any kind of call. What they do to communicate is they pantomime with each other. They have all these fantastic motions that they make with their wings and with their beaks and with their heads. And I found a monograph that was published years ago based on Florida brown pelican behavior that talked about what these pantomime gestures meant. And I realized, oh, I filmed a couple of those on the Channel Islands before I even knew what I was doing. So there's a section in the movie that includes, you can see what a pelican does when he wants to tell another pelican, I like you.
We're speaking with filmmaker Judy Irving about her documentary Pelican Dreams, which opens Friday at the Angelica Film Center in Dallas. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. With more than 100 courses and non-credit certificates for adults from fine arts to history to financial planning, spring registration is now open. Registration and information at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with filmmaker Judy Irving, who directed the documentary Pelican Dreams. It opens Friday at the Angelica Film Center in Dallas. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Judy, we hear about the colossal oil spills that happen every few years. A lot of smaller ones, though, don't really attract media attention, but they can still be devastating for seabirds. Why is oil so dangerous for pelicans and other seabirds?
Basically, oil, it's not that they get totally coated, although some of them do, but if you're a seabird, you've got a protective, almost like a dry suit of feathers that are waterproof. A seabird's interior temperature is something like, for a pelican, it's 103 or 105 degrees. They operate a little hotter than we do. And the reason they're able to stay warm in the cold ocean is because they're waterproof. Their feathers keep them waterproof. So a spot of oil, it can be the size of a dime, breaks that waterproofing apart and allows cold seawater to penetrate underneath the feathers, making the bird cold. And so what happens is, even if it's just a tiny bit of oil, the bird gets cold, doesn't want to fish, avoids fishing because it's, you know, too uncomfortable, ends up starving, and ends up on the beach. So this is something I didn't know about oil, but even fish oil can do this, any kind of oil. dumped motor oil, fish oil, oil from cooking French fries, anything that's a contaminant can disrupt the waterproofing on a seabird's feathers. And then it's, you know, then it's all over unless they get saved by a rehabilitator and made waterproof again.
And how do they do that?
Basically, they have to wash the bird. In the case of the Gulf oil spill in 2010, they were able to save a bird that I obtained footage of. It was completely drenched in this chocolate brown soupy oil. And they were able to wash that bird. Sometimes they use Dawn dish detergent, which is apparently very good on oil. Seventh generation is also good. Anyway, it's very, very stressful for the bird, but they can get it off. And then they rinse the bird, and then they dry the bird. And after the poor seabird goes through all of that trauma, then when they have time to rest in the aviary, they start preening their feathers. And with their beaks, they can preen the feathers back into position so that all the little barbs and all the little hooks and everything connect again. You've probably done this with a feather. And all of a sudden, they're waterproof. You know, and then the rehabbers are very, very careful to check the waterproofing to make sure that a bird is completely waterproof after an oil spill before they release them. So, but it can be done. And they have put bands on these birds, and they do survive. They often do survive.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak to Scott in Grapevine. Hello, Scott.
Hello, Chris. And can you hear me okay?
We sure can.
Okay, great. I am a professional wildlife photographer and spent several years covering brown pelicans, including spending 6 months at a pelican rookery. So I was very pleased. I came into the program a little late, but I was very pleased to hear somebody doing a movie on a documentary on brown pelicans, because there hasn't been much on the birds. And nothing that I'd seen in many years in print. The last decent book I saw on brown pelicans was done about 1983, and I had one planned, or actually still sort of have it planned, but the economic crisis broke it up because I had started working on it in 2008. Bad time to do that. Anyway, I had a few observations. One was that I covered birds along. I covered brown pelicans along the Texas coast, and now I've forgotten what I was going to say. Anyway,
what was the colony? Where did you hang out with the brown pelicans? I'm curious.
Kind of protection of the birds. I kind of don't.
Oh, okay. Okay. That. Never mind.
however, if you want to contact me, I'll discuss it with you directly, but not.
Okay.
So after the call, I can give my contact information.
All righty. Thank you so much, Scott. It is interesting. I mean, clearly Scott has a great love for brown pelicans, and I know you do now. They are beautiful. They're not sort of like cute in the same way some other wildlife is. And has that hurt them in terms of, you know, people's sort of desire to make sure that their habitats are pristine, that sort of thing?
Well,
I know it sounds like a silly question, but you know what I'm saying, right?
Yeah, I do. They're not really cute, but they are charismatic.
Mm-hmm.
And lots of people do notice them along all of our coasts, of course, and inland, the white pelicans on the lakes. They have a certain presence, and I think they garner a lot of respect. They might not be everybody's absolute favorite bird in the world, but I've met an awful lot of people since I made this film and since it's been coming out in the theaters who have pelicans as their favorite bird. And, you know, what's really neat about getting to know more about them, and finding out what they need to live a healthy, strong life translates directly to better stewardship along our coasts, because they live along the coast. They need that habitat to be clean. They need to have enough fish. You know, there's an awful lot of problems with overfishing. So when you become a pelican advocate, you automatically become an advocate for the habitat. And that has to be a good thing, because we depend on our coasts as well.
I love the point made in the film that surviving as a wild animal requires what for humans would be something like peak athletic form. And it made me think about wild animals in a really different way.
Yes, especially for pelicans who do this incredible high dive, which is really literally as hard as anything you've ever seen in the Olympics. They have to be able to see well, and they have to be able to dive well. And if they can't do either one of those things, they are just not going to make it out there. It's a hard world being a wild animal. You have to be at the peak of your form physically and mentally too. You know, they're constantly on the lookout for safe places to roost at night, like offshore rocks or jetties that are, you know, that don't have any predators, breakwaters that are completely surrounded by water. They have to be aware of predators, and they're constantly, like a lot of wild animals, on the lookout for food, for fish. I see pelicans soaring along, you know, and they look they look really contented and everything, and magnificent and graceful. And then you'll see them bend their head down and point their beak down and kind of let their legs and their feet hang. And they're looking down, and they're looking for fish, you know. So it's just a constant thing. It's tough. We're not used to that. We don't remember how hard it is to be a wild creature, because we have all these creature comforts.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Harold in Athens. Hi, Harold.
Hello. How are you?
Very well. Thank you.
I have a place on the Trinity River in Trinidad that has a 20-acre natural lake. And about 9 years ago, I had a brown pelican appear on the lake. Now, this is totally natural with small islands, a lot of brush. But the pelican appeared, obviously had been injured because it could only flap, could never get up in the air. But he lived on the lake for about 7 years.
Wow.
As they normally dive and did all that, this lake was only 5 foot deep, but it had plenty of small fish. How did it survive?
Wow, that's amazing. You know, sometimes I have actually seen brown pelicans swimming on the surface and dipping their heads under to get fish, if there are lots and lots of fish. Sometimes they will do that. And so your pelican did that, just decided to adapt, you know, and act like a white pelican, because that's how they get their fish. They would just dip their head under and scoop up the fish and drain out the water, and then there you go. That's a pretty amazing story.
Why do so few pelicans survive their first year?
Well, this is another thing that was a surprise to me. There's a tremendous amount of sibling rivalry in the nest. Pelicans lay eggs. They lay their eggs, the first egg, and then a couple of days later, they lay the second egg, and a few days later, the third egg. Okay, so the first egg that hatches, that bird starts getting fed right away, gets bigger than the second bird, who is in turn bigger than the third bird. And so if you're the third-born chick, you're smaller just from the get-go, and you have to compete with your siblings for food. The parents feed the baby pelicans by regurgitating fish out of their beaks. And the pelicans are constantly nagging the parents to get fed. So, you know, that firstborn chick is bigger and can get more fish. So it tends, the problems tend to intensify as they grow up. And often that third chick doesn't make it. This happens in the wild, and it's really sad to see, but it seems like, I don't know, nature has decided that that third chick is sort of like an insurance policy or something. I don't know. They make it so seldom. But so if there's lots and lots of fish out there, all three might make it. But when I was on the Channel Islands, I only saw one nest that successfully raised two chicks to the point of fledging. Most of them only raised one. And that was because there weren't enough fish. There weren't enough anchovies.
When you're doing wildlife filming or videography, I mean, obviously you can't like hoot and holler when something good happens. Is it a different sort of experience than shooting other kinds of things where humans are your primary subject?
Yeah, it's very different. Basically, you cannot tell wild animals what to do, where to show up, when to show up. You can't tell them that you really want a certain kind of behavior because they may not ever do it for you. You know, there's an awful lot of time spent sitting around and standing around next to the camera waiting. And what happens is that you kind of relax. You go into a more meditative state. You kind of bring your own pace down to that of the wildlife around you. And I think the natural world operates at a slower pace than urban humans do. And so that's kind of a nice side effect. You just get to slow down too. And you start noticing more things. I think anybody that goes out for a walk or sits by a lake understands what I'm talking about. The longer you sit there quietly, the more you notice, the more you see, the more you hear. And so as a wildlife filmmaker, that actually is one of my favorite things. I love that. And I crave that. And that's why I do it.
Filmmaker Judy Irving directed the new documentary Pelican Dreams. It opens Friday at the Angelica Film Center in Dallas. Judy, thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.